Okay, so the Dhamma for today is the Tiratana. Ti means three, Ratana means treasures. It's often translated as jewel or gem, but it is a word that's used more generally to refer to treasures. So we often talk about this as the triple gem or the three jewels. But that's not probably accurate. They're not thought to be jewels, they're thought to be treasures, valuable things. Ratana is something that is of the highest value. So in Buddhism, these three things are the three things of highest value. Not in the sense of highest value to our practice. As you might think, well, that would be referring to the three trainings, right? Those are the most valuable thing. And that's true. But these things are, the usage of the word ratana relates more to their nature of being worthy of reverence. So these are the three things that we put in the highest position in our minds. And that these, of course, are the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. This is something that you find equivalent to in many different religions. The objects of worship. What are the objects of worship in Buddhism? They are the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. So this is a very basic teaching. Something that anyone who has learned anything about Buddhism should know right off the bat. Nonetheless, because of their place and because of their value, learning about them and reminding ourselves about them is an important part of our practice. You'll notice that they come up regularly. Anytime we take the precepts, anytime a lay person takes the five precepts or the eight precepts, even when novices take the 10 precepts, the first thing you do before you take on these training rules is to go to the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha for refuge. Every day in our chanting, our daily recitations, we start by reflecting and recollecting on the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. We end the daily chanting by asking forgiveness of the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. There's a reason for this. The repetition, the returning again and again, day after day, regularly to these three things, is a valuable part of our practice. It's supportive, it's reassuring, it's encouraging, it has value. These things are not treasures that you put up on a shelf and look at. They're things that are a part of your life, and they have a value, a very real and practical value to our lives and our practice as Buddhists. So what are they? What is the Buddha? The Buddha here, the word Buddha means something like one who is awake, one who has become awake. It's often, and I think in Thailand, mostly translated as one who knows. And they do acknowledge the other translations, but one who knows is probably not the most accurate and the most likely for a simple translation. We have other words for knowing. Budj is in regards to waking up. When you wake up in the morning, patibudjati, you wake up. So the Buddha is someone who has become awake. It's a reference to the idea that we're all sleeping because of our ignorance and because of our delusion. We're lacking in wisdom, we're lacking in understanding. So the Buddha has come to know in a very special way that has caused him to wake up and free himself from the mistakes that come when you're asleep or the mistakes that come when you're blind and so on. So we start the Buddha's story countless time ago when he was the ascetic Sumedha. He was a very powerful ascetic and had special attainments and qualities of mind, and he was famous and well renowned in India at that time. And he found out that there was a Buddha, Buddha Dipankara, was coming, had arisen and was coming to teach, and the people were clearing the path, and so he helped them to clear the path, but they gave him the worst portion of the road to clear, because they knew he had special powers, magical powers that would allow him to clean it. But he wouldn't use those powers. He thought this was an important task, so he wouldn't make it easy on himself, and he just worked his way trying to clear this muddy, swampy path that the Buddha was going to walk on. And he wasn't able to complete it in time, and the Buddha came, and he saw the Buddha coming and realized two things. One, that if he were to listen to this Buddha teach, he would very quickly be able to become enlightened. And two, that if he were instead to sacrifice himself and give up his own attainment, that he could make a determination in front of the Buddha that he too would become a fully enlightened Buddha at one time. So we have this ancient this story of ancient times where Sumedha made this vow, decided not to follow the Buddha's teaching, and instead sacrificed himself for the Buddha to walk over. And when the Buddha refused to walk over him, he went off into the forest and began his training to become a Buddha. He spent 4 uncountable eons, an asankhya. It's a period of time that you can't count. He spent 4 of these periods of time. So you can count the number of them, but you can't count how long an asankhya is. Asankhya, it's uncountable. Plus on top of that, 100,000 great kappas. So an unfathomable amount of time. Cultivating the 10 perfections. And a great way to gain respect and appreciation for the Buddha is to read about these past lives of the Buddha, where he spent all of this time cultivating the 10 perfections. You can read about them in the Jatakas. We have an English translation. And they're worth reading, at least some of them, if you're interested. And then finally, in his last life, he was born as Siddhartha Gautama, spent 29 years in perfect luxury as a prince, until finally realizing that this life of luxury wasn't going to free him from suffering, wasn't going to bring true happiness and peace. And so he left home and spent 6 years eradicating wrong view and finding the middle way, and then spent an entire night focused on the practice of meditation and became a Sammasambuddha. So the Buddha is the one who dedicated himself to learning the truth for himself. He is the one who found the way to become free from suffering by himself, without any help, without any direct intervention from any other being. And so we praise him for that, for his greatness in that way. The qualities of the Buddha are ananta. The texts say ananta guna. The Buddha was someone with limitless qualities. His virtues, his positive qualities are unlimited. And you'll see there are books and poems and verses written just with this express intent to enumerate some of the Buddha's qualities, and they'll go into great detail about all the many qualities. But in brief, we summarize the Buddha's qualities as 3. Number 1, his wisdom. So it's said that the Buddha had perfect wisdom and could understand every single thing about the universe. Any question that was asked of him, he could answer. Any knowledge there was, he could exert himself and get the and arrive at the answer without difficulty. Most importantly, he understood the Four Noble Truths: suffering, the cause of suffering, the cessation of suffering and the path that leads to the cessation of suffering. And he learned these things by himself. The second is parisuddhi, his virtue of purity. So, first of all, and most importantly, the Buddha had no defilements. He had no greed, no anger, and no delusion. And that's remarkable and exceptional. And he attained this without any help, without any instruction. But even that is only on the level of other enlightened beings. All of the Buddha's enlightened followers who became arahant also freed themselves from greed, anger, and delusion. The Buddha had another quality of purification, is that he had no idiosyncrasies. So an ordinary person, even when they become enlightened, still has their personality. They might have personality quirks, and they certainly have faults, flaws in terms of their behavior, in terms of their qualities of mind. So an arahant will forget things and will be lacking in different kinds of knowledge. But the Buddha had this complete purity that he was free from that. And so all Buddhas, whenever a Buddha arises, they're very much similar because they have a purity of being with no idiosyncrasies or specific habits. They have the Buddha's way. And finally, what we call Mahakaruna. So the third quality is our acknowledgement of the Buddha's great compassion. First of all, and most importantly, was his compassion in taking the time to become enlightened, to become a fully enlightened Buddha, when he could have at any time given it up and become enlightened under another Buddha and passed away without ever having created the Buddha Sasana that we see today. But equally important, when the Buddha became enlightened, after becoming a Buddha, he realized that none of it was meaningful at all, and that actually teaching people would not be to his benefit whatsoever. There was no reason to go out of his way to teach. Teaching was something that was difficult. People would not understand it. So he naturally inclined not to teach. This doesn't mean what he had done was in vain. It just meant that he showed that the natural inclination of an enlightened being is not to go out of their way to push their teaching on others. Meaning he would require, if he was going to teach, someone else to ask. But the great compassion is that when he was asked to teach, he accepted. And he spent 45 years dedicating his life to teach once he was invited to teach. So there's a reminder there that we don't go out of our way to push the teaching onto others. We don't dedicate our lives to enlightening other beings. But that in memory of the Buddha's compassion, we accept an invitation to teach. And we teach when there is a need for it, when people express the need and the desire to learn. So these are the three qualities of the Buddha: his wisdom, his purity, and his compassion. The value of the Buddha to us, if it needs to be said, what great value is the Buddha for us? Is first and foremost as a leader, and as a object of confidence and encouragement. Everything that we do in Buddhism, all of our practices, are dependent on an understanding that they come from a good source. For a person who doesn't yet realize the teachings for themselves, they require some amount of confidence. And a great amount of this confidence comes from our knowledge and learning about who the Buddha was. Of course, in the time of the Buddha, it would mean the meeting with and interacting with the Buddha that would lead to this great confidence. Now all we have is the memories. We have the texts and we have the stories. But even those are of great benefit to helping us gain confidence and encouragement in our practice. Of course, there's the value that he took the time to teach, but as far as the Buddha himself as an icon, he's the pinnacle of humanity. If you learn his story, you can't imagine a being greater or more perfect than him. And so we take him as an object of reflection, and this gives us great encouragement in our practice. The second treasure is the Dhamma. So what is the Dhamma? The Dhamma is in brief, two things. The first thing that it is the truth that the Buddha realized. This aspect of the Dhamma the Buddha didn't create. So it's not, you couldn't say, it's, well, in a way it doesn't belong to the Buddha. As the Buddha acknowledged that this was the truth that he discovered. It is his in the sense that he discovered it, but not in the sense that he made it up. The Buddha didn't make up the three characteristics. The three characteristics are an aspect of reality. And the Buddha pointed this out. If you read the sutta, the Dhamma Niyama Sutta, the Buddha said, whether a Buddha arises or doesn't arise, impermanent suffering and non-self are the nature of reality. For example, the Four Noble Truths, the Buddha didn't make these up. But the other aspect of the Dhamma is the things the Buddha created, starting with the precepts, the five precepts, eight precepts, 10 precepts. These are something that the Buddha established. These don't exist in nature. You couldn't you take a microscope or a magnifying glass or sit in meditation and realize that these things actually exist. Even the four satipatthana, even the five aggregates. Now, body and mind, nama and rupa, is a part of nature. This the Buddha didn't think up on his own. It's clear that one part of reality is mental, one part of reality is physical, and there's no denying that. But as far as categorizing them into the five aggregates, when you put the first one as rupa, and then you say vedana, sanya, sankara, vijnana, to do that, even though it's accurate and perfect, it's still something that the Buddha created. And there are, of course, many teachings like this, many Dhamma teachings. The Dhamma is separated into three parts. The aspect of the Dhamma that is the Vinaya, relating to Sila. And this is in the Vinaya Pitaka. The aspect of the Buddha's teaching, the aspect of the Dhamma that is Samadhi. This is in the Sutta Pitaka, which deals mainly with meditation practice and the cultivation of good qualities. And the aspect of the Dhamma that is wisdom, panya. And this is found in the Abhidhamma. So if you read the Abhidhamma, you can see the nature of reality, just lists and lists and categorizations of reality. It's not so much a teaching, it's not really practical, but it's an exposition, it's an expression of the depth of the Buddha's wisdom, the depth of the mind that has attained understanding. As far as the qualities of the Dhamma, the special qualities of the Dhamma are found in the reflection of the Dhamma, where we repeat every evening, Sva Kato Bhagavata Dhammo. The Dhamma of the Blessed One is well taught. But why is it well taught? What is so good about it? Sanditiko. The first quality of the Dhamma is that you can see it for yourself. It's something that is able to be realized. It's not theoretical, it's not something you have to take as an article of faith. You don't have to believe anything about the Dhamma. You just have to test it and try it and see it for yourself. Sanditiko, akaliko. Akalika means it's nothing to do with time, timeless. So one aspect of that is that even today the Dhamma is relevant. It's not something specific to some culture or some time. But I think more importantly, and probably what the Buddha was referring to here, is that it has nothing to do with a certain amount of time. It's not something that requires you to practice for years or lifetimes. It's something that requires a quality of mind. And that can take time to develop. But it's not how many days or how many months or how many years. It's about how quickly and how skillfully you can cultivate the teaching. It's something that has nothing to do with the future and nothing to do with the past. It's not something where you practice expecting some kind of a result. It's something you practice here and now, and you focus on the present moment. It's important that as meditators we try our best not to get caught up in results or goals or future attainments, and that we focus more on the quality of our mind here and now. What is the quality of our mind and the quality of our practice? Try to cultivate a practice that is perfect and positive and leading us upanayiko, leading us onward and onward, so that we don't ever have to doubt or worry about whether we're on the right path, because we're focused on the path. We have a clear awareness and perspective, seeing the path for what it is, without reference about, is it getting there? Where is it going? When am I going to get there? It's the quality of the practice, the quality of our minds, that is the most important. Ehi pasiko means you can come and see. You don't have to believe someone else, or you can't rely on someone else. Nobody else can practice for you. No one else can give it to you. Upanayika means it leads you onward and onward. When you practice a little bit, there's always something more, step by step by step, and it leads one step after another to complete and perfect freedom from suffering. And finally, paccatang veditapo vinyuhi means a wise person will know it for themselves. So it's not something that we use to brag to others. Obviously, it's not something that we can even share with others. You can't express it to someone else. You can't explain to someone what you have attained. You can tell them, you can brag about it, but paccatang, we tend not to brag. Paccatang means it's private. We tend not to, but here it means specifically that you have to attain it for yourself. And it's something that rather than being described or being acquired by listening to someone else, it's something that you gain for yourself, and you have to see it to believe it. You can't easily express it to someone else, but someone who cultivates wisdom will realize it for themselves. What are the benefits of the Dhamma to us? What is the value of it to us? There are three parts. One is pariyatti. We gain study, knowledge. We gain knowledge that helps us live our lives, even just knowing about the five precepts, the eight precepts, knowing generally about ethics, knowing about greed, anger, delusion. Even studying the Four Noble Truths can be very helpful in life. Knowing these things as theory can help us come up with correct answers to life's questions, to the problems and challenges that we face. You'll see many Buddhist scholars or students who have learned about Buddhism, people here in Sri Lanka, when they learn about Buddhism as children, it helps them in their lives. Of course, it's not a deep or profound change of who they are, but it's something that can be used to guide. Even pariyatti is very useful. The second is patipatti, that we practice. The value of the Dhamma is that it's something that we can put into practice. We can take it as our way of life. The Dhamma is the way we live our lives. It gives us the practice of not only ethics, but also meditation. We can undertake the practice of samatha meditation and vipassana meditation, and we can undertake mindfulness in our daily lives, to help us live our lives in a better way and to lead us in a direction which culminates in the attainment of enlightenment. And so the third is the results of the practice, pativeda. These are the three sadhamma: pariyatti sadhamma, patipatti sadhamma, and pativeda sadhamma. Pativeda is the realization. But ultimately, of course, the Dhamma is the most valuable thing there is, because it's the attainment of enlightenment. It's the attainment of freedom from greed, freedom from anger, freedom from delusion, and freedom from the suffering that comes from those three things. The third is the Sangha. The third treasure is the Sangha. Sangha means community. And there's a mistake that often occurs. I think even here in Sri Lanka, it's common to take the Buddhist monks as the Sangharatana. And that's not actually accurate. Monks are by no means the treasure or the object of reverence. They're not even all that valuable just because they're monks. A monk can be a terrible person with no ethics or concentration or wisdom. It's certainly possible. Because it's samatthi. This sangha is a samatthi. It's a concept or a construct. We all agree and we establish, based on the Buddha's instruction, that four monks or more who have all ordained properly according to the rules and have not committed aparajika, so they are still monks in good standing, at least four of those is a sangha. And more generally, you could say the group of all the monks in the world is the sangha. But this is not Sangharatana, this is not the treasure of the Sangha. It's a different community that we're talking about. Of course, the community that's the treasure is called the Arya Sangha. So the Arya Sangha is a group of people, a group of beings, but it's the group of all those beings who have become enlightened, and there are four of them. There's the Sotapanna, someone who has seen Nibbana at least for the first time, and they have freed themselves from wrong view, freed themselves from wrong practice, freed themselves from doubt through their attainment of enlightenment. But this is a person who has seen Nibbana. There is the Sakadagami who has further practiced on from being a Sotapanna, so they have very little greed, very little anger. There's the Anagami who is free from sensual desire, free from anger. And there's the Arahant, who is free from all kinds of delusion, all kinds of distraction, all kinds of defilement. So these four are the Arya Pugala, and this is what is meant by the Sangha. The qualities of the Sangha generally are that they practice correctly. The Sangha is anyone who has practiced, not only practiced the Buddha's teaching, but they have practiced it to the extent that they have reached the goal. They have practiced sila, they have practiced samadhi, and they have cultivated wisdom. This is the qualities of the Sangha. They are worthy of reverence. They are people who are truly worthy of appreciation. And they are people who can receive gifts and support and respect and worship from others rightfully, that they rightly deserve it, and they have no need to feel indebted to those who support them because they are rightly supported. It is right to support, it is right to care for and appreciate and worship and revere these beings. So what value is the Sangha to us? The Sangha is a value to us in three ways. The first, again, as an example. So when you read about the Buddha's teaching, it might occur to you that this is all theoretical and it's all potential. But until you have an example of someone who realized the Buddha's teaching, so the teaching is still just theoretical and some sort of subject of doubt. So when you have the Sangha, when you see the Sangha, when you see beings who have attained enlightenment, even just realizing that this is someone who is calm and serene, this is someone who is composed, this is someone who is wise, this is someone who is at peace, someone free from greed, anger and delusion, even just meeting these people. Like when Sariputta met Asajji, one of the five monks, and was just immediately taken by his deportment and knew that this was someone special. Having the acknowledgement that there are beings who have realized the Buddha's teaching and seeing these people and talking with them is of great value first and foremost before even learning anything else about them. The second benefit is the example of their lives. So when we read the stories about the arahants, when we read stories about the monks in the commentary and the 80 great disciples and all of the work that they did, we have a great example not just as proof, but also as a mode of practice. When you learn about the things that they did, you can take their actions, their words, their lives as an example. For example, we have Mahakasapa, who had a very austere way of living and kept rag robes and didn't lie down to sleep and only went on alms round and lived in solitude. He was a very austere sort of monk. We have Sariputta, who never reacted when others spoke ill of him or even attacked him or accosted him. We have story after story. If you read these stories about the arahants, they're invaluable for providing us with an example of the way that we should live and what we should strive for. The third benefit of the Sangha, of course, is as teachers. So we have in the text, we have teachings of Sariputta, teachings of Moggallana, even Ananda, and teachings of Mahakasapa. But we also have them as teachers generation after generation. So even today we find people who appear to have practiced correctly, who have cultivated themselves to the degree that they appear to have rightfully reached the goal of the Buddha's teaching. And these people provide us with teachings through books, through speeches, even through conversation. When we have meetings with them, the daily meetings with the teacher, there's a great value in them as the Sangha because of the clarity and the capacity that they have to lead people in the direction that they have already gone themselves. So these three things, again, the three treasures are the most valuable things that we have. They're treasures that we revere. So part of it is holding them up on a pedestal and revering them. But more importantly, we can use them as objects of reflection because they give us encouragement. And more importantly, just practically, they are the foundation of our practice, the foundation of our path as we bring ourselves towards peace, happiness, and freedom from suffering. So that's the Dhamma for today.